Yeah, so this is the case of State versus Duncan, and you may be seated, and we believe now have Ms. Vincent on the WebEx. We will begin by introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
I'm Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Jonathan Pappy.
Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. Mr. Cordes, you are here with us today. Good morning to you. And Ms. Vincent, you are with us by WebEx. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, thank you.
Mr. Cordes, when you present to the court, we would appreciate it if you take your mask off. You can wear it otherwise, please, but in order for us to hear and understand what you have to say when you present, please do that without your mask on. And with that, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, honorable members of this court, may it please the court, my name is Robert Cordes. I represent the appellant in this case, Daryl Duncan, also known as Iman Muhammad. This is a case where we are seeking ultimately a new trial under the DNA Testing Act. The standards of review applicable to all of the assignments of error are as follows. Actions under the DNA Testing Act are addressed to the discretion of the trial court. This court will not disturb the trial court's findings unless there is an abuse of discretion. Further, the court's findings will be upheld in the absence of clear error, where the evidentiary ruling, where the evidence rules commit the evidentiary question at issue to the discretion of the trial court, an appellate court reviews the admissibility of evidence for an abuse of discretion. I thank you for having read the briefs. I'd like to supplement that brief with a little bit more tone provided by the closing arguments. I promise it won't be a long read from the record, but I begin with pages 1080, 22, or 17 to 22, and this is the prosecution's closing argument. Was this about a robbery? But what you find on Mrs. Bennett's bed, along with her body, and it has been left there to bleed to death after being stabbed, what you find is that things are spread out on that bed, that they've been gone through, moved around. It's very obvious. I mean, there are things such as pantyhose. There are three wallets. One is on the dresser. It's the cream-colored wallet. Two of them are on the bed, a black and a red wallet, and they're empty. They've been gone through. They've been taken apart. Somebody's looking for money, okay? The evidence suggests that those wallets have been taken apart. Matter of fact, the picture section of the red wallet has been taken out, even looking through. Prosecutor goes on to address the tan purse that's been rummaged through and that there was no wallet inside the purse. Prosecution continues at 1085, 1 to 12. Well, as you know now, the only way a suspect's DNA at a scene is that the suspect is injured and bleeds, and there's nothing to suggest that the defendant was injured in any way, and argues that the only thing that the absence of DNA shows is that the person committed the murder was not injured. There's nothing that suggests any other than the defendant committed this crime, nothing whatsoever. And in the defense closing argument, it's simple. At 11, 12, 24 to 25, says there's no evidence of DNA. If there was, you'd have it. We stipulated that DNA didn't show anything. We stipulated that all the blood was evidence. So the red and black billfold we tested the white billfold as well. And the red and black billfold showed there was biological material. There was DNA. And the evidence shows that, and more favorable to the defendant, it was not the defendant's DNA. We get to the standards, and it's really the heart of this case, is what to do when you have these favorable results. And
you referred to the prosecution's closing argument, making reference to the billfolds and the suggestion that they're gone through. And is there evidence of that, or is the prosecutor asking the jury to make inferences?
The prosecutor is asking the jury to make inferences. Now, in respect to the evidence there was evidence about dog hairs present, but of course there was also evidence that the dog and the defendant and defendant's former wife had been in the house. There was evidence about fingerprint attempting, but no fingerprints evidence on these items. This is a robbery murder, and the prosecutor is arguing that the items of the robbery were the red billfold and the black billfold, as well as everything else on there. Your Honor, this is, you know, it's in evidence. This is a picture of the body here of Lucille Bennett. I'm shaking. But right next to it is the red billfold, and right next to that is the black billfold within the cradle of her arms. And they're empty. The prosecutor is saying somebody's gone through this. And so somebody's gone through it, likely source of DNA had tested. Somebody's DNA is on there. More likely than not the defendant's DNA. That's evidence favorable to him.
What, if anything, you make of the apparent conclusion that it's very unlikely that Ms. Bennett's own DNA was not?
Not on one of the wallets. What we can make, that is a wallet, the red wallet, that was empty when they were showing through. It's also a wallet, somebody else's DNA on there. What you can make on that, from that, Your Honor, is that somebody else's DNA other than Mr. Duncan and other than Ms. Bennett is present on the scene there. And so if somebody else's biological material is there, it must be from somebody outside that source. Now, on the black billfold, you have, you know, it's a zero. It is equally likely that it's Lucille Bennett's DNA on there as it is an unidentified unknown person. And so you can make a better argument that, you know, maybe it's there, but there's no scientific evidence to support that. But these are items that belong to her. They're right there on the bed.
Were the wallets offered into evidence at trial?
Yes, the wallets are in evidence. The fingerprint testimony about that is in evidence. And then the argument was that somebody went through those, got money orders that the decedent had purchased before, and then went to Chubb's Food after the murder and cashed those money orders. So they're going through, the argument is they're going through these wallets, they're finding, and the purses, they're finding the money orders, and then they're cashing them as part of a robbery. That's the theory of prosecution. So when you have evidence that somebody else could have deposited the DNA on the very items that are at the heart of their robbery, it becomes important context in deciding what to do with it. And if I could address how to do with it, the standards that we use, because they're very important, and it seems to be in some evolution. You know, before from Palmer, we had, does it create a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt? Does it not merely impeach or contradict the eyewitness's testimony, but is it probative of a factual situation different from that which the witness testified? You talk about probabilities, a substantial different result, the probability of a substantial different result would occur if the evidence had been admitted at the trial. At the end of Palmer's case, you begin to talk about cases from other jurisdictions. And as you do, you use this language. Other courts from other jurisdictions have similarly reasoned that DNA evidence warrants a new trial when it compromises key evidence that the prosecutor used against the defendant at trial. As an appellant's lawyer, I would respectfully like to see that in the point headings at the beginning, and that become the hallmark. And then they cite to a number of cases from outside this jurisdiction, and they're in footnote 21 in the Palmer case. And I would like to supplement that with another case, In re Bradford, 140 Washington App, 124, 2007 case, which is an evidence DNA case where there was a confession on the part of the defendant, but there was also a mask involved, and the mask had eye holes cut out, and there was tape on the eye holes. And the argument was that if you looked at that tape, you might find somebody else's DNA on the tape from the eye holes. And they said yes. When considered in context of the evidence at trial, that was enough to warrant a new trial in that case. Now, what I worry about most often in this case is how we're using the language of exclusion. You see it in White, it makes an appearance in Palmer, and we had the benefit of Palmer. But what I worry about is using extreme cases like the Myers, the Dona, Alfonso, where you have, you know, patently frivolous DNA requests for testing. And it's easy to dismiss those. And then you like Hale, and we begin with some language in there about exclusion. And then you take Palmer.
I beg your pardon. Let me be clear. You are focused on a request for a new trial, not a dismissal, correct?
Right. We're not seeking exclusion. This appeal deals solely with the motion for a new trial.
Right. And is there anything about our, I shall suggest, uniquely written DNA statutes, the language thereof, that supports your view?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the definition of exclusion, I mean, exculpatory evidence supports the argument as well. And I think the language, there's language in Palmer that supports it. What I worry about is when we deal with exclusion and what that means. In Hale, this court defines exclusion as a complete match on all the loci. And so we begin with a situation where it was 9 loci that the labs were looking at, then 16, and now we're at 24. And to get an exact match or an exact opposite, you pretty much need a single source contributor. If you have a mixture, you need to account for all the participants in that mixture, and you need to know it in order to get all 24 loci to look at whether it's there or not. Now, the Hale case came down in August of 2020. Before that, I don't know if this court's familiar with SWATDAM, but it's a group of forensic scientists that advise the FBI, and they're considering in 2020, what's the best way of presenting statistical evidence. And they're not talking about using exclusion or exclusion. In fact, they recommend don't use inclusion at all. But they give standards, and they give standards from the likelihood ratio of 1 to 99 being one threshold, and 99 to 10,000 be another. And they're leaving it up to the labs to define what they want to use for exclusion. And it isn't all a complete absence of the 24 loci on the known sample compared to what you're comparing to. And, you know, that isn't in the record. I know that in Palmer, you looked at evidence of statistical manuals for DNA to determine, you know, the 5% on a minority. But I encourage this court to look at the SWAPTAM standards. It's SWPDAM. And there's counseling on what the threshold should be for the scientists to explain their DNA testing results. And it leaves it up to the labs to determine what is exculpatory or not. But the point is that no one's using exculpatory as all the loci being matched or not inclusion. In fact, the scale goes from uninformative to limited support, moderate support, strong support, very strong support. When I talked about
Mr. Cordes, I think your time is
okay.
Is up.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning again. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Duncan assigns two errors on appeal, which I will address in reverse order. The first claim is the district court erred by refusing to consider the evidence offered during his post-conviction proceeding in 2008. I disagree. Section 29-2101, subsection 6, by its express terms, limits the evidence that will justify a new trial to newly discovered exculpatory DNA evidence or similar forensic testing evidence obtained under the DNA Testing Act. And as this court's case law makes clear, the probative value of that evidence is to be assessed within the context of the defendant's former trial, not some future trial where additional or different evidence is presented. The district court properly refused to consider the post-conviction evidence for that reason alone. However, this claim fails for two additional reasons. First, Duncan's complaint about LaWarrie's credibility was considered and rejected by the district court in his post-conviction proceeding in 2008. He cannot relitigate that claim here, and even if he could, there's no reason to believe that the result would be any different. And second, this claim ignores the fact that LaWarrie's testimony was corroborated by other witnesses who were present during her phone calls with Duncan and confirmed both the timing and the content of those calls. Thus, even if the district court had considered the post-conviction evidence, it would not have changed the result in this case. Duncan next claims the district court erred by denying his motion for a new trial. Again, I disagree. The issue here is whether the DNA evidence, if offered and admitted at Duncan's former trial, would have produced a substantially different result, and the answer is no. The DNA evidence did nothing to diminish or weaken the state's evidence against Duncan. The jury was aware that neither Duncan's DNA nor his fingerprints were found anywhere at the scene, and his absence and the absence of his DNA on the two billfolds was simply more of the same. Moreover, as this court has repeatedly recognized, the absence of a defendant's DNA on an item doesn't preclude him from having been in possession of it. And where the defendant's DNA is not detected on an item, results are at best inconclusive, especially where there is other credible evidence tying the defendant to the crime. That circumstance is present here. The evidence, the state's evidence showed that Duncan needed money. He was in the neighborhood on the date that Bennett was murdered. There were no signs of forced entry, and he was one of the few people that Bennett would have allowed into her residence. LaWarre recognized the pot in Bennett's sink as one of her own, which placed Duncan inside the residence, as did the dog hairs on Bennett's bed, which were consistent with hairs found on Duncan's jacket and with the hair from his pit bull. Most importantly, the testimony concerning the two phone calls in which Duncan disclosed details about the murder that he couldn't possibly have known unless he was present. And those phone calls were devastating, and frankly, I don't think any amount of DNA could diminish the strength of that particular evidence. So for those reasons, I submit the district court properly denied Duncan's motion for new trial and asked this court to affirm.
What's the significance of the DNA expert's testimony, whether or not Mr. Duncan excluded as a contributor to the DNA on the bullets?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I had difficulty hearing you.
What's the significance of, if any, of the DNA expert's testimony as to whether or not Mr. Duncan could be excluded as a contributor to the DNA on the wallets?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I would note that the likelihood ratios that were generated in this case are pretty weak. And the fact that he can't be excluded, I think, leaves open the possibility that, in fact, he was a contributor. And by way of comparison, if you recall, the State v. Simmer case was also a case that involved a probabilistic genotyping program. And if you look at the likelihood ratios that were generated in that case, they are far stronger than what we have here. On the knife, it was 3.71 thousand times more likely that it was Simmer than some random person in the population. And then the DNA on the doorknob, it was 4.22 quintillion. So we're more accustomed to seeing those kind of numbers in these cases. But I think the fact that he can't be excluded just lends to, you know, credence to the fact that those, the probative results or the probative value of those results isn't great.
At closing argument, did the prosecution argue to the jury that Mr. Duncan had gone through the wallets? If so, what's the significance of that?
She may have argued that. I mean, I think it supports, first of all, it doesn't contradict the state's evidence. I mean, the robbery was established by virtue of the money orders that were stolen and cashed. I mean, we know that it was a robbery because items of value were taken. That's a given. I think she was drawing an inference based on the fact that the wallets were around her, and it appeared as though they had been gone through. Now, were they? I don't know. I think it's a reasonable inference, but for all I know, those money orders were lying out in the open. Maybe she was preparing to pay her bills, and they just happened to be lying there. So he actually stabbed her, grabbed the money orders, and left without touching anything. Because what we also know here is that there was $233 in cash found in an eyeglass case, a tan purse, on the floor next to the bed. So that purse wasn't gone through, and I don't believe there were any fingerprints recovered from either of the purses that were dusted for fingerprints.
Thank you.
Again, if there are no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't believe there is any time for rebuttal. There is no time for rebuttal, so that concludes arguments in State versus Duncan. Again, thank you, counsel. You are excused. Mr. Cordes, as you leave the courtroom today, please do that through the side door.